B. Collins. Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, July 25th, 2019. Another record heat wave afflicts Europe. The United States just recovering from our last bout of excessive heat. Today in Paris, 108 degrees. And I was in southern France during the heat wave that hit there at the end of June, and it was miserable, I have to say. I hope that people are not going to end up dying because of the extreme conditions. And the heat is on Robert Mueller. After his uneven, sometimes almost senile testimony before two committees of the House of Representatives yesterday. And I turned to Britain's tabloid, the Daily Mail, to get the numbers. They refer to Mueller as Dodgy Bobby. He deflected lawmaker questions 198 times. He asked lawmakers to repeat their questions 30 times. He referred answers to his report 34 times. He said questions were beyond his purview 10 times. And 99 times, he said that he can't or won't get into the substance of a question that was posed by either a Democrat or a Republican. And so, Bob Mueller revealed himself to be a fairly ordinary human being. A guy who couldn't remember who appointed him as the U.S. attorney in Boston. He said it was Bush, but the Democrat who was trying to burnish his credentials as a national hero had to remind him that it was Reagan. St. Ron to Republicans. And I refer to Mueller as St. Bob because so many people thought that his investigation was above reproach, that he is this unbiased man of deep character and great integrity. And the truth is far from it. And I think a lot of people were shocked when they saw his performance yesterday, stammering, halting, limiting himself to one-word comments like an angry old man who just yelled at the kids to get off his lawn. And so the Democrats were reduced to using deposition tactics. They would quote a line from the Mueller report and get him to agree with it. Sometimes with a single word, other times he might elaborate with a sentence or two. And as I mentioned yesterday, I couldn't find anybody who actually challenged the evidence, the fact gathering, and the conclusions that were drawn in the Mueller report. And he repeated the claim of sweeping interference by the Russians in the 2016 election. But nobody asked him to detail what that actually means, because we all know what it means, right? And there is one exception. And it pains me to quote this guy. I know Tom McClintock. He was in the California Assembly for many years. He grabbed a congressional seat in a red district north of Sacramento, even though he didn't live there. And he's been dragging his knuckles as a Trump supporter and a Tea Party guy all along. But he is one of the few people who challenged the claim that the Internet Research Agency based in St. Petersburg operated these messaging campaigns on the internet and in social media, and that somehow brainwashed millions of Americans, or at least enough of them, to get Trump installed. So Tom McClintock, who didn't get an answer to his question, said, "You've left the clear impression throughout the country through your report that it was the Russian government behind the troll farms. And yet, when you're called upon to provide actual evidence in court, you fail to do so." Now, this relates to how the company called Concord Management that either owns or runs the IRA in St. Petersburg, they shocked Mueller by actually responding to his indictments and defending themselves in U.S. court. And like every other challenging question, Mueller shined him on. So I'll give Tom McClintock credit. He was trying to really get Mueller to prove the assertions that he makes in his report. And it's interesting when you really focus deeply on the language that Mueller uses. And he's very disciplined when he can be. He talks about it as allegations. He says, you know, that it was a Russian effort to meddle in the campaign. But we saw the partisans see what they wanted to see, hear what they wanted to hear. And when you look at his performance, Dana Milbank, who's an insider at the Washington Post, a columnist there, his piece today is headlined, "So This Is Why Mueller Didn't Want to Testify." He stammered, licked his lips, consulted his aide, begged forbearance. "Could you repeat that? What was the question? I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I apologize. Can you start over again?" At least five times he was reminded to speak into the microphone. And he used what I consider to be a series of double negatives. He struggled to say that his report had not exculpated or exonerated Donald Trump as Trump complains. Or as Trump claims. And so we saw a series of double negatives. Essentially, Mueller was saying that they found him to be not guilty. So they're not saying he's innocent, of course, and they're not saying he's guilty. And the games that were played in the 7 hours of testimony of Mueller playing dodgem and of partisan politicians trying to score points in their 5 minutes? It was pretty disgusting. Now a comment on some of the commentators' comments. Over at the New Yorker magazine, columnist John Cassidy, a clear investor in Russiagate, is defending St. Bob Mueller. He has a litany of complaints about the way the Republicans treated him, starting with Louis Gohmert and ending with Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin. And he writes, "The wanton disrespect that these elected Republicans showed Mueller was perhaps the most alarming testament yet to Trump's total conquest of the party. In today's GOP, as in Stalin's Russia," get that red baiting, huh? "Evidently, decades of loyal public service count for nothing when the leader and his henchmen decide someone represents a threat and the apparatchiks have been ordered to take that person down. It was left to the Democrats," he says, "to remind the millions watching about the bronze star that Mueller received, the fact that the U.S. Senate confirmed him and reconfirmed him unanimously to the FBI job." And that was a devastating dereliction of duty, in my opinion. He never should have been given the extra 2 years as FBI director. And nobody ever explained publicly why that was necessary, or what kind of backroom deal Obama made to grant him an extra 2 years? Was it so he could continue to violate the constitutional rights of Americans with national security letters? Well, we'll get to some of the negatives of Bob Mueller here in a moment. Now to Dan Baltz at the Washington Post. He declares that the prospect of impeachment is now dead. Headline, "Democrats are now left with one option to end Trump's presidency, the 2020 election." He writes, "If Democrats hope to end the presidency, they'll have to do so by defeating him in November 2020. Many hoped that his testimony would suddenly change public perceptions, dramatically jumpstart long-stalled prospects for an impeachment inquiry. That was certainly the Democrats' goal. And he concludes, if anything, things could move in the opposite direction. And I think that may be fair. Lawrence Tribe, a pro-impeachment Harvard law professor, quote, "Much as I hate to say it, this morning's hearing was a disaster. Far from breathing life into his damning report, the tired Robert Mueller sucked the life out of it." And Balt's column continues, "At the end of the day, Pelosi remained cautious about moving ahead with an impeachment proceeding, noting that there are ongoing court cases. She denounced the White House for a cone of silence, massive cover-up. And then she kind of confused things by saying, if we have a case for impeachment, that's the place where we will have to go." And over at the New York Times, they let Carl Hulse lower the boom on impeachment. His opening line, President Trump was probably never going to be impeached by the House of Representatives before the 2020 election. The testimony by Mueller makes that a near certainty. The absence of an electrifying Washington moment in Wednesday's two-stage testimony not only deprived Democrats of the crystallizing episode they needed to drive public opinion on impeachment, but it also meant Republicans had no reason to budge from their anti-impeachment stance. Pressure will continue from the left, could become so irresistible that the Judiciary Committee begins what it will call an impeachment inquiry without a formal House vote. And Hulse closes with this. In the meantime, Mueller's testimony didn't provide an obvious galvanizing reason for the House to open an impeachment inquiry, nor did it cause a breach among Republicans that could help Democrats move forward. Only one Democrat shifted her position in favor of impeachment in the hours after the session yesterday. And so we're really mired in here. Now, despite those pundits, Elizabeth Warren, running for president, urged the House to rise above politics and launch impeachment proceedings. She said, "This is a moment in history, and every single member of Congress should be called on to vote and to live with that vote for the rest of their lives. I read the Mueller report the day it came out. When I got to the end, I didn't stick my finger in the air and ask about the politics. I didn't hesitate. This is a man who has broken the law, and he should be impeached." Well, I applaud the senator for that. Bernie Sanders, quote, "He's not exonerated." He called Trump a racist, Sanders did, who is trying to divide the American people based on the color of their skin. He's called on the House to begin that impeachment process, said it's a matter of fact that the president did everything he could to obstruct the Mueller investigation. And I don't know why they don't talk about the Cohen plea deal. That is slam dunk evidence of a conspiracy to affect the outcome of the election by paying off the women who said they had sex with Trump. Joe Biden, "I think there are impeachable offenses. The president should be tried for them. I think it's something the House has to come about in an orderly way so the American people understand this is not done for political reasons." Kamala Harris, senator from California, supports impeachment, accused the attorney general of misleading the American people about Mueller's findings, and said that Mueller's public testimony would help set the record straight. Her opponent, Cory Booker, also a senator from New Jersey, agreed that the House should begin impeachment proceedings. South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg says impeachment would bring more facts to light, but he thinks they'd stall in the Senate. "I'm focusing on defeating him in November of 2020. Amy Klobuchar, not addressing impeachment, just said, "The king is not the law. It's time for Donald Trump to stop the racism and leave the White House," but she doesn't say how. I guess she wants him to resign. Beto O'Rourke supports impeachment. "There must be consequences, accountability, and justice. The only way to ensure this is for Congress to begin impeachment proceedings." Now, interestingly, my congressman from here in Northern California, Jared Huffman, used to be Beto O'Rourke's Washington roommate. They shared an apartment there with one other member. And at BuzzFeed, I am proud to hear the comments of Jared Huffman. He said, "I didn't expect more than this. I do think that Mueller's hearing, it's a bit of a dud, but that's what I was expecting all along. The bigger takeaway is probably the questions he refuses to answer." Now, Huffman, who supports impeachment, went on to say that leaves us in a frustrating place. "Frankly, our Democratic majority has pinned a lot on Mueller and his report. In retrospect, we made some tactical mistakes. The party has lost the messaging war to Trump," Huffman says, "and by raising expectations about Mueller's report and putting the council on a pedestal, the party now lacks a clear message about impeachment." One more quote from Huffman. "The whole thing leaves us at a deep strategic disadvantage to the Trump administration that is willing to shout these lies in the right-wing echo chamber, and they have succeeded." And a colleague from Rhode Island, David Cicilline, who heads the party's messaging arm, he's out of step with Pelosi. "To not open an impeachment inquiry in the face of such obvious corruption is an abdication of the oath we took to defend our country, uphold the rule of law, and hold the president accountable for his misconduct." Over at Consortium News, my friend Joe Lauria, along with me, a skeptic of the Russiagate narrative, made some interesting points. I didn't hear this exchange, but he says that somebody asked Mueller about the claim by the Guardian newspaper of Britain that Paul Manafort visited Julian Assange at the Ecuadorian embassy. Mueller refused to refute the story, for which there is no evidence whatsoever, and so he left it alive. And in talking about the role of the Internet Research Agency, Laria points out that Cambridge Analytica had data points on 240 million Americans, and they spent millions of dollars for the Trump campaign on Facebook. I always consider that much more significant than anything the Russians may have done. And he also talks about an exchange between a congressman, Michael Turner of Ohio, and Mueller related to the exoneration claim. And the Republicans make a legitimate point that an attorney general or a special counsel is not authorized, and we've never seen a case before, where they will say that someone was not exonerated who was also not indicted. It seems to be not just poor form, but highly inappropriate, if not a sanctionable offense. Also, I want to thank Linda Lewis, who linked me up to The Real News, who interviewed Colleen Rowley. She's an FBI whistleblower who I've talked to on many occasions. She recaps some of the truth about Mueller, about his blundering in the anthrax case after 9/11. And she talks about some other issues, too. She and Joe Lauria both advanced the argument that you can't exonerate somebody, and I think that's accurate. But they also say that you can't pursue obstruction of justice charges if there's no underlying crime. And I don't agree with that argument, but I respect their right to make it. I've also linked in today's show file to an article by Kevin Ryan, who lists the history of cover-ups conducted by St. Bob Mueller, including his role in the Whitey Bulger case, Pan Am 103, the BCCI case, and he also references the anthrax case. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Wendy Gebauer, Joey Perillo in Philly, Paul Tomaselli, and the amazing Faith Peoples, who has more subscriptions than I can keep track of. I'm grateful for their support. I'd like yours, too. This is my soft pitch for you to become a subscriber. Just hop on to peterbcollins.com, click on the menu tab, click on Become a Subscriber, and in short order, you can choose the level of support that's comfortable for you. And hey, I get it. If you're allergic to PayPal, use the U.S. mail and communicate with me at Box 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Want to squeeze in some other news today, and there is quite a bit going on. Tulsi Gabbard, who is a Democratic candidate for president from Hawaii, she serves as a member of Congress. She participated in the first round of debates on June 27th. And for a period of 4 or 5 hours after that, it appears that her Google accounts were blocked. And she argues in a $50 million lawsuit filed against Google that shutdown of her account hampered her presidential campaign, caused people to be unable to find more information about her and donate to her presidential run. Now, I think there is a legitimate issue here, but from what I can gather, the outage was only about 4 hours. Google says it was done by an automated system by some sort of AI that had detected unusual activity on the Google Ads account of the Gabbard campaign. What's also noteworthy is the New York Times coverage of this is yellow journalism, all right? It begins, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, the long-shot presidential candidate from Hawaii, sued Google. The lawsuit is believed to be the first time a presidential candidate has sued a major technology firm. It continues in a twist that reflects Ms. Gabbard's unorthodox political views. The claim that her speech was stifled by Google is similar to complaints made over the last year by Republican circles. I don't agree with that. Then it says few Democrats have raised similar concerns. This is a specific case. And I have an email from the Gabbard campaign. And it says that Google controls 88% of all internet search. For hours, Tulsi's campaign advertising account remained offline while Americans everywhere were searching for information about her. And during this time, Google obfuscated and dissembled with a series of inconsistent and incoherent reasons for its action. Well, I think this is a good, you know, as I say, I think there is some basis for the suit, but I think this is clearly a publicity stunt, and it may work. Running against Silicon Valley is not a bad gambit these days. But I have to share with Tulsi Gabbard fans that she has lost a staunch supporter and a man who's a very generous supporter of this podcast. John Zwiebel lives in Hawaii. He has been touting her candidacy to me. He sent me a yard sign and a Tulsi T-shirt. Thank you for that, John. But he's through with her. Yesterday, learning that Tulsi Gabbard had voted for House Resolution 246... which is the measure that denounced BDS aimed at Israel. Zwiebel writes that after she voted for it, I no longer need concern myself with the presidential election at all, or for that matter, any election. He goes on, Tulsi was my number one choice, my only choice, but to know that Tulsi chooses Israel and war with Iran over decent treatment of the Palestinians indicates she is controlled by the Israeli lobby just as much as every other candidate for president. Yeah, I'm sure she had no other choice since the Israeli lobby is so strong. I don't care. I'm just out of here. And in a message sent to the Gabbard campaign, don't expect another donation from me. Please remove me from your mailing list. I have discontinued all of my recurring contributions for all Democratic candidates. I cannot express to you how betrayed I feel. And John, I share your pain about that. I just praised Jared Huffman for his position on impeachment and his candid remarks about the failings of the Democratic Party. But he voted for that piece of shit the other night. Protesters have won a victory in Puerto Rico, where Governor Ricardo Rosselló, I've been coached on how to pronounce his name, has announced that he will resign on August 2nd. Now, he's doing a little jockeying because, under the Constitution of Puerto Rico, the successor would be the Secretary of State. But that person resigned last week, caught up in the same scandal that has brought down Rosselló. So the Secretary of Justice, Wanda Vazquez, is in line to step up to be the acting governor. But she has allowed that they might maneuver a new Secretary of State into place who would precede her in the line of succession. Now, this one reminds me of the infamous scene on Capitol Hill when tobacco executives went to declare that smoking was safe and that there was no linkage between tobacco and cancer. Well, the major opioid manufacturers have asked the judge in Cleveland to throw out the first test case of the liability that we believe they have for the nation's drug crisis, arguing that two Ohio counties can't prove that the drug company's actions were responsible for overdose deaths or other harms. Purdue, the company that's run by the Sackler family, the biggest maker of opioid drugs, Mallinckrodt Pharmaceuticals, and their allies contend that the counties cannot sufficiently connect the tens of billions of legal painkillers the companies produced to fatalities and addiction. Nor can the counties show that drug company sales calls cause doctors to overprescribe the medications. It's deny, deny, delay, delay, deny, delay. Meanwhile, people are dying. A federal judge in Arkansas has blocked three new abortion laws that would impose serious restrictions on a woman's access, including a measure prohibiting the procedure 18 weeks into pregnancy. It also blocked laws requiring that doctors performing abortions be board certified or board eligible in obstetrics and gynecology. But it is only a temporary hold. Yesterday, I noted that a federal judge in D.C. had upheld Trump's asylum policy. And today, I am glad to see that Judge John Tiger here in San Francisco issued a nationwide injunction saying that Trump's proposed laws would deny asylum because the applicant passed through another country on the way to the U.S. By barring asylum to all who enter another nation without seeking refuge there, the Trump administration, quote, turns its back on those requirements. So the injunction will take effect, and appeals courts will now take up the case, which you can expect an imminent appeal from the Trump administration. It happened on Tuesday, but we didn't learn about it until late last night. At the federal lockup in Manhattan, Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted pedophile who is now facing fresh charges, he was found in the fetal position on the floor of his cell with some injury to his neck. Now, the officials are treating this as a possible suicide attempt, but he was on suicide watch. And why did they delay announcing this incident? We don't know. We also know, and I'm not speculating here, but he has a roommate who is a former cop named Nicholas Tartaglione, and he faces federal charges in connection with a quadruple murder in Chester, New York. Now, we know the cops and that other prisoners are often very hard on convicted pedophiles and other sex offenders. So we'll wait to see what the investigation reveals. And today, Whitney Webb at Mint Press News has published part two of her series called The Jeffrey Epstein Scandal, Too Big to Fail. And she delves into Roy Cohn, one of the most powerful figures in American politics in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and a mentor to Donald Trump. And she looks at the long arc of sex scandals that were used to blackmail people, including the callboy ring run by Washington lobbyist Craig Spence, the Franklin child sex and murder ring that we have talked about, run by Republican operative Lawrence King, and the scandal that enveloped the Catholic charity Covenant House in the late 1980s. And the entire piece, I'll review it tonight and comment further if I think it's necessary. But she says that she is able to show them connected to the same network that involved key figures linked to the Reagan White House and Roy Cohn, revealing the true scope of the sordid sexual blackmail operations and sex rings that have involved the trafficking of children within the U.S. and even in Central America for their exploitation by dangerous and powerful pedophiles here in the United States. The Trump administration, through Attorney General Barr, has announced that they will reinstate the death penalty. The feds have not executed a man since 2003. There are five men convicted of murdering children scheduled to be executed in Terre Haute, Indiana, in December or in January. And finally today, I want to celebrate how activists, artists, used their power to force a man off the board of the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York City. Now, I attended the Whitney's Biennale. That is a biannual exposition of art that does a lot of political commentary. And I was impressed with many of the works of art that were displayed there. And over the last couple of weeks, eight artists told the Whitney to remove their paintings or other objects of art in protest over the board membership of Warren Kanders. Kanders owns a company in Jacksonville called Safariland. They make law enforcement and military supplies, including bulletproof vests, bomb-defusing robots, gun holsters, and tear gas. And after reports that their tear gas grenades had been used against migrants at the U.S.-Mexican border during protests, these artists launched their own protest. And yesterday, Kanders, age 61, who has donated more than $10 million to the museum, he wrote a memo, a letter of resignation, where he attacked the protesters who had protested his business. I side with the protesters. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it far and wide. I remain Peter B. Collins, and you'll find this on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.